Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly digest of original crime and mystery fiction. I'm Linda Lanigan, editor of the magazine. In our podcast series, we bring you readings of short stories from the back issues to give you an idea of what the magazine is about. For this episode, we have Chris Music reading his story, The Horde, from our July-August 2014 double issue. The story, about a relationship between two co-workers, deals with enabling behaviors that mask darker issues. Chris read the story for us at the 2015 VoucherCon convention in Raleigh, North Carolina. Chris is a communications specialist and editor at North Carolina State University. Here he is, reading The Horde.
Her place looked run down. The brown trim on the little ranch was peeling, and the wooden shakes were faded and water-stained. The neighboring homes, big Cape Cods with bright vinyl siding and tended lawns, bookended her house into its raggedy quarter acre like an old paperback. On each flank of the ranch, the silvery boards of a tall fence screened off what looked like a nursery gone wild. A crowd of poplars, unruly evergreens, and tall bushes had grown into a solid barrier of vegetation back there. The front lawn, a mishmash of grasses predominated by crab, needed mowing, except where it had succumbed to patches of rusty moss. There were no hedges or flower beds, and hers was the only house along the block whose garbage bin had not been rolled out for the sanitation men. If there was a male in the household, he was either elderly, incapacitated, or a wastrel. An old Chevy station wagon, sun-faded to a powdery blue, was backed into the driveway. He was surprised, because Marley always took the bus to work and had arrived by cab the few times he had persuaded her to go out with him. Maybe the car was out of action. Now he suspected she had been too embarrassed by how her place looked to let him pick her up here. Moreover, she might resent his coming by on his lunch hour. But it was the second day in a row she'd called in sick. He wasn't about to go another 24 hours without seeing her. And unless he was totally deluded, she seemed just as eager to see him every day. It was scary to think she was feeling so low as to miss their daily rendezvous in the workplace. Or maybe he was deluded. No. From the minute he'd first made contact with the shy, absinthe-colored eyes during orientation, seen the tension in her sharp, pale face relax into a moment of unaffected interest, he'd been hooked. Forget that they worked in the same place, or that he'd been burned before by strange, introverted girls. He was hooked. He turned off the ignition, but did not withdraw the key. His instincts told him he was facing an awkward domestic situation in the shabby little house. He had forced himself to respect her reticence until now. What did it matter as long as he was with her someplace? But he had begun to stew over this mysterious home life of hers. Was she in need of rescue? Was someone actively undermining their relationship in that hitherto unseen place while he foolishly honored her wishes to keep his distance? Had this house gone to pot under the rule of a household tyrant who would not lift a finger except to blight her life? There was only one way to find out. He got out of the car and crossed the street. The whole neighborhood looked deserted, as if every inhabitant had gone off to work or school and left Marley totally alone amidst empty-eyed habitations, ornate mailboxes, automatic sprinklers, and abandoned Hot Wheels. He went up the cracked walk, stabbed the doorbell before he could talk himself out of it, and stepped back so he would be full length in the peephole. No one came to the door. He rang the bell again, holding the button down an annoying number of seconds, but still no one came. He knocked loudly. "Marley." He pulled his cell phone out and dialed her home number. He could hear the phone ringing inside. It stopped. "Go away, Jack," she said huskily, like an asthmatic. "Are you in there alone?" "Yes, but go away." I'm going to make a racket until you let me in. Please don't. The neighbors hate me already. That gave him pause. You could not imagine anyone hating Marley. Why would she think that? I'm not leaving. Let me in. I can't. I'll be at work tomorrow. I'll see you then. Open up. Enough's enough. He banged on the door to emphasize the point. All right. The words were wrapped up in a sob. He was about to smack the door again when it finally opened a crack. He had an impression of loose hair, house coat, unmade face, green eyes hidden by a downcast look. Please, Jack, if you really care about me, just leave now. You can see him a little under the weather. I'll be okay tomorrow. But he sensed another presence looming behind her, tall and foreboding. He pushed against the door, felt her resistance, but got it open enough to see past her into the front room. Jesus Christ, he said. There was no place to sit. They stood at arm's length in a narrow crevice between head-high stacks of cardboard cartons and packaging, sealed trash bags, boom boxes, board games, plastic toys, half-rolled sleeping bags, unframed prints, and other nondescript junk that took on the aspect of a landfill. The air was musty and close, and he could taste unsavory odors pushing in from other rooms. It was a moment of truth for both of them. Marley, ankle deep in detritus, cringed like someone pushed unwillingly into a spotlight. The frayed, oversized robe hid any hint of the body that had preoccupied Jack's imagination. Nevertheless, she seemed utterly exposed. As for him, it was suddenly time to decide whether to open himself to another badly wounded person or walk away. Choose long-term guilt and loneliness or the awful intimacy of shared suffering. It seemed his fate to be always choosing between unhappy courses of action. Who would speak first? Marley tried. She lifted those compelling green eyes. Her lips parted, but it was as if stones had filled her larynx. Her eyes grew moist with the harrowing appeal of someone drowning just out of reach. Without any more thought, he stepped toward her, took her gently by the arms. She tilted forward, collapsing into him in slow motion. "You have to explain this," he said, encircling her slumped shoulders. "Make me understand." He followed her along a path whose footing was made treacherous by slides of toppled junk. Eventually, they reached a screened-in porch at the back of the house, in which a grotto-like hollow allowed room for two lawn chairs and a small glass table. Looking left and right, he counted three washing machines, two dryers, and numerous small appliances. These were just a platform for more plastic bags and moldering cardboard. Beyond the punctured screens, foliage loomed and reached toward them as if nature were trying to join the chaos within the house. At least the air was fresher and cooler, though it still carried traces of mold and mildew. Somewhere along the passage to the porch, she had picked up a heavy knitted shawl. The weight over her shoulders seemed to pull her down into one of the chairs. Jack examined the crisscross of ragged fabric that comprised the seat of the other chair and sat down tentatively. The shawl's fringe hid the lower part of Marley's face. She said, "I didn't want you to see the clutter." "Clutter? Is that what you call it?" "Don't yell at me." She hid her face completely now, cringing like someone threatened with a hot iron. He controlled his tone, refrained from touching her. He did not want to become part of the problem. Personal experience had taught him that troubled people often had the inexplicable tendency to recreate the source of their own torment. He must not become a surrogate for whatever had sent Marley off on his crazy accumulation. "I'm not crazy," she said quietly, but startling him nonetheless because her words echoed a part of his thoughts. "I know," he said, "but I want you to try to describe what's happened here." "Why should I? Can't you just believe that it's all necessary?" "No, Marley, it'd be no good to you if I did that." Her eyes emerged from the shawl, turned on him with fear and curiosity. Try as he might, though, he saw no hope in the green rounds. The old man had come and gone continually, using the home like a hideout. Molly was sure he did bad things out in the world to match the bad things he did to her and her mother. When she was still little, the latter had started fortifying the house with things put aside for an uncertain future. "Wait," Jack said. "Your mom started all this?" "She had to. It was the only way to stop him from coming right for us. Sometimes he couldn't find us at all. And all the things she used to wall him away were for when he finally stopped coming back." He shook his head over that one. "Is that what happened? He stopped coming back?" "I haven't seen him since I was 13, 9 years ago. But it doesn't mean he's never coming back. Maybe whatever he was doing landed him in jail or got him killed. I've tried to find out about him on the internet. It's like doing a research report on someone who disappeared off the face of the earth. If he's in jail, Jack, he's in under a different name. And he'll be out someday. He can't be dead. No one could kill him." She seemed very certain of that last fact. It gave him a chill. "Where's your mom, by the way?" Molly's eyes broke their tentative contact with his, drifted toward the jungle out back. "I had to put her in a place. I'm sorry. Strain must have got to her, right? But we can't let that happen to you. Why don't you move?" She laughed, a little lapdog laugh. "Who'd buy this place? I can't afford to just walk away from it either." She was trapped, at least in her own mind, like he himself had felt in certain situations. "If we clean it up, maybe you can unload it. Get free of your..." He stopped, at a loss to describe her condition. Her head moved in small, negative shakes. "Look, if you were someplace your father couldn't find you and had another way of facing the future, not alone, couldn't you break free? Don't you want to?" "I've never thought about it. It doesn't seem possible or safe." He gestured at everything around them. "This is safe?" "It has been." "Listen to me, Marley. From day one, I've had this sense that you were looking to me for something. Something you couldn't even express to yourself. Maybe this is it. Let's give it a try, one room at a time. You pick the first one." Her hands were clenched prayer-like inside the shawl. After a long moment, she said, "If I do what you want, you can never change your mind. You have to see it through with me." Or invisible sleet assailed her face. "I'll end up like my mother." After a long moment, he said, "All right." Something with the heavy tread of a palmetto bug moved in the crevice between the derelict washers. Marley didn't seem to hear it. She admitted that rather than being sick, she was in one of her slowdowns, a mood swing that made it too much of an effort to get out to the Y for a shower or around the block for a restaurant meal. "So you can't even wash yourself or cook a meal here. Isn't that inconvenient?" Indeed, the kitchen was no more than a storage area, the stove and countertops buried out of sight. An empty pizza box sat on top of a case of cheap soda, beneath which stacked cans of kidney beans and corn niblets gathered dust. At least the stuff was in the right room. "How can you afford to eat at restaurants all the time? We don't get paid that well. At least I don't." "Someone left me money," she said. "It's almost gone." That last admission was like a hidden sin dragged out of a kid during confession. "So, you're low on cash, and you're sure as hell not going to be able to hold down a job if you keep getting sucked into these slowdowns. People won't put up with it. And your slumps probably have to do with the way you're living in this house. It's got to change. You're burying yourself alive." The reality of his outsider's perception touched her like a point. She pulled the shawl over her head in panic and despair. Jack, afraid of the reaction, put his arms around her and felt her tremble like an abused animal, all her sex appeal swallowed up by misery. "All right, here's the plan. I'm going to call in sick for the rest of the day. We'll get you over to the Y to get cleaned up, which will automatically make you feel better. Then I'll buy you a real meal. Tomorrow it's back to work, It's Friday, so it's just one day. On Saturday, we begin. You pick the room. It's got to be. Under the shawl and the belted robe, the slim body shifted toward him, and after a long while, the trembling stopped. By then, it had come to him as keenly as the sense of mortality that if he failed this girl, he would fail himself, and the pangs would last as long into the future as his mind remained lucid. It might be the last chance for both of them, the last opportunity to push out the accumulated mass of things that would otherwise engulf them. Jack overheard co-workers commenting that Marley looked a little peaked that Friday. She was often the subject of scrutiny from both sexes. But her secret life was as safe as ever from them. He could not suppress the normal excitement of being inside a loved one's closed circle. But it was tempered by a strange alloy of pride and repulsion when his duties brought him near her workstation and its fragrance of lilac and the telltale accretion of papers and office supplies. He knew now why she was so partial to the headier scents. But he detected no trace of the household odors encountered the day before. They ate lunch together in the outdoor atrium. He had made sandwiches for both of them so that she would not have to expend more of her dwindling inheritance on deli food. "Where do you sleep?" he said out of the blue, startling himself with the sudden need to know. He had not thought about it during the poignant farewell at her door the evening before. Perhaps he had dimly imagined some chamber of immunity inside the house, a sanctuary of clean linen and untainted air. But now he realized that that was an unrealistic supposition. Her expression became oddly angelic. "I have my spot," she said. "My things reach up like willows over and around me, press against me. I have my blankets from when I was a little girl. It's my nest." He had mixed feelings about testing the reality against her comforting description of it. Her spot was not likely to be the bower she described. Yet her fondness for it highlighted the abnormal comfort the wacky surroundings gave her. He just hoped her resentment would not outweigh affection as he pried her loose from her illusion. He watched her like a covert bodyguard throughout the day, even felt a pang of jealousy when the office Lothario, Brad Borelli, leaned into her cubicle with smarmy self-confidence. Nor was Brad the only man drawn to her vicinity. Circumstances had not detracted from her waifish beauty, not yet. Jack dampened the negative emotions, marking her brief but cheery smile for Brad as part of a shared deception. "Good job, Marley." The pretense extended to Marley's insistence on keeping to her commuting routine, taking the bus rather than accepting a ride home from Jack. "Why? And how come you don't drive in? Is that station wagon not running?" "It still works, but when I'm driving it, I have to stop all the time to pick up things." "Like what?" "Like perfectly good stuff that people throw away or decide to sell in a yard sale." "Let me drive you. It'll save you the bus fare." "Just not ready for the world to know I can be with someone," she said. An odd position in his estimation. But he resorted patiently to his customary non-resistance, cognizant now of where her impulses came from. Saturday's assignation was set for 9 a.m. This time the neighborhood was populated with kids at play and adults at their various chores. The nearer faces turned to him with sharp curiosity, maybe even hostility, as he went up the walk. Marley had told him the bolder kids called her the witch or the rat girl, and that some of the older folks had gone to the town or circulated petitions about her property. "I don't have rats, and the house was paid for a long time ago. As long as I keep up with the taxes, they can't do anything. I'm not breaking any laws." But being fond of kids, she was wounded by their cruelty. She had quite a cache of toys and games that she had always meant to distribute to those around her. But it seemed unlikely now that she would ever be given the opportunity. "What have you decided?" he said, handing her the bagels and coffee he'd picked up en route. "The den," she said. "My father's den." It was a room she said she was never... I have to start that one again. It was a room she said she never visited or contributed to. Her mother had filled it in during the years of her father's lengthening absence with acquisitions that even Marley couldn't rationalize. A raft of rolled rugs, a bundle of rebars, a weight machine, and other heavy items piled up as if to hold down some erupting force beneath them. "How did she move all this stuff?" Jack said. "Did you help her?" "No, I'm not strong enough. She got somebody else to help." "Well, now you got somebody to help move it out. I take it you're not so attached to this stuff." She shook her head. "And your mother will never know, right?" "No, she'll never know." "Well, we can put some of this at the curb for the town to pick up. Half of it will disappear when the drive-by collectors come through." Sorry, no offense. "None taken." "I'll rent a truck for the real junk," he continued, "and we'll take that to the dump. Maybe your neighbors will cheer up when they see stuff going out rather than coming in." "Screw them," she said. She was startled by the witchy bitterness, but her pique quickly dissipated in the heady steam from a coffee container. She munched a bagel with childlike pleasure. They made slow, laborious progress through the day. During one achy break, he asked impulsively if he could see the sleeping spot that she'd been so rapturous about. The coy look she gave him was almost creepy. "You have to behave there," she said. "I don't think that will be a problem," he said to himself. Her room was upstairs. Ascending was a risky balancing act, and the door to her room would not open all the way because of the press of possessions behind it. He pushed it back as far as he could and looked in. After a few moments, he said, "Where is it? The spot?" She pointed, shyly, to a narrow opening between a leaning, half-buried bureau and a bale-sized clump of clothing and gift boxes. A slack pillow, a bedspread, and a couple of tattered knit blankets lay on the uneven surface at the bottom of the aperture. A closed laptop poked out from under the pillow. Beyond the bedding, a doorless closet bulged with a freeze-framed explosion of garments. "Cozy, isn't it?" she said. "I guess." This, her refuge, would be the toughest room to tackle. They just have to work up to it. "Come on, let's go back down. We're on a roll." He avoided looking to see if her feelings were hurt by his retreat. The overhead light in the den did not work. They uncovered a wall receptacle that did, however, and after much trial and error, a floor lamp from Marley's collection that actually worked. As dusk descended outside, Jack was determined to get a few more things into the rental before knocking off. Together, they wrestled a sack of hardened concrete mix out to the foyer and onto the dolly that came with the truck and went back for a second one that had lain beside it. Marley froze as she stooped to grab her end. The edge of a big black vinyl bag, flattened by the weight it had borne, pressed out from under the cement like a congealed puddle. Canvas handles were stitched into both sides, and the bag was sealed shut by a heavy-duty zipper. "Oh, boy," Jack said. He'd seen bags like this when he was a volunteer firefighter and had helped clear a bad train wreck. Marley dropped to her knees, reached for the zipper slide. "Marley, don't do it." But he was paralyzed, unable to stay or slow, fascinated movements. The bag unzipped, disclosing a second transparent layer within. Through the clear vinyl, they could see a pair of shoes and a hint of bone embedded in slush. Marley put her eyes close to the inner bag. "Those are Daddy's shoes," she said. "The alligator ones with the sharp toes." They retreated to the grotto after Jack finally pulled her up from her prostration. She wasn't crying. She seemed very thoughtful, leading them out like a mute guide through a ruined landscape. Jack refilled plastic glasses with Cabernet left over from lunch and took a gulp, but Marley barely touched her lips to the wine. "I just need to calm down before we call the cops," he said. Marley set down her glass on the little table. "We can't call the police," she said. The words jangled in his ears like a foreign language. "What are you talking about? We found a dead body." "It's my father. Someone wearing his shoes when he got stuffed into that bag. It's him. Now I know why he never came back. He was always here." All right, it's your dad, but we can't hide the fact that we found a body. She looked at him as if he'd suddenly morphed into a complete stranger. If he died naturally, my mother would have called the police. She wouldn't have hidden him away like that. I was thinking the same thing, but your mother's beyond being held accountable, right? Jack, please, if we report this, there'll be an investigation that will tear everything apart. What's done is done. It's been dead for years. That stuff has been piled up there since I was a little girl. Let's just put him out with the trash, which is what he was. He drained his glass, poured more. Marley leaned closer, strangely assertive, holding his eyes within the green facets of her own. He'd never been hypnotized, but now he understood how it could happen. Jack, you're the one who begged me to change my life, not to ruin it. The police will bring in a search warrant and rip the house apart faster than I could possibly bear. And who knows what else they might uncover. What do you mean? She got up slowly. Follow me. He drained his drink, knowing he'd probably need both hands free for balance. As he put his glass down beside hers, dread seeped in behind the wine he'd drunk. They threaded their way through the kitchen and mudroom. The ladder connected to the garage. Jack levered the door open wide enough to admit his bigger body, and Marley clicked on a flashlight. The ceiling bulb's burned out, and I can't get to it, she said. The garage space was a terminal moraine of human artifacts. She moved sideways into the gap, separating stacks of junk poised like the two halves of the Red Sea. Halfway in, she stopped and lifted a flap of tarpaulin. The light shone on torn shrink wrap and a few small stacks of U.S. currency. Remember I said someone had left me some money? How long have you been living off this? We started using it when my mother got really sick and lost her job. I only use it to supplement my income and for taxes, but I've been out of work sometimes, too. You can see there's not much left. But what if there's more hidden out here or in the house? You're saying it's probably stolen. Probably. And if it is, even though I didn't steal it, we used so much that I could never replace it. Isn't that a crime? A police search might turn up more, and that's even bigger trouble, right? My house could turn into a giant crime scene. We'd have no control over how they moved things around or what they took away. I'd be in bad trouble, I know it. I don't think you've done anything seriously wrong. That's you. But what about the justice system, which always gets things screwed up? To them, I'd just be someone who knowingly used stolen money. Will they believe that my mother killed my father in self-defense, which is what had to have happened? I don't think so. She leaned into the open embrace of two bicycle handles that jutted from the mass of things. There was no room for him to take over the duty of comforting her, nor could he debate her. The raw emotion of her argument was impossible to refute. What's this? He asked to distract her. He was fingering a wooden case underneath the money stash. Pull it out and open it, she said. With a little effort, he wrested it free and opened the hinged top. Inside were a handgun, two loaded clips, and what was probably a silencer. See what I mean, she said hopelessly. They'll find one thing after another, but they'll dismantle the place doing it. I would not be sane by the time they were done. Having set the emotional hook, she quietly extemporized a simple plan. They should finish uncovering the body bag, drag it into the backyard jungle, and bury it in the dark. He countered, observing that the foliage was just as impenetrable to outside observation in daylight. Why not wait until they could see what they were doing? He was angling for a cooling-off period, but she wouldn't budge. How are we going to dig? He said finally. There's probably nothing but roots under the dirt. We'll need dynamite. No. There's a clear spot in the middle where nothing was planted. It was the place where my mother sat in nice weather, so no one could see her. I have plenty of shovels in case one breaks. She had an answer for everything that threatened the hoard. A sharp, emotional tie to her things put something demonic in her voice, and he could easily imagine her mind unhinging completely were this crazy stockpile to be dragged out into sunlight for the world's inspection. If she snapped like that, well, he and she would be severed like limb from body, leaving him memories only of pain and past connection, of which he had already taken a full measure. "We'll have to be careful we don't snag it on something that will spring a leak," he said. The soil wasn't entirely rootless, but the spot Marley picked after some deliberation was soft for several feet before Jack hit sand and stone. She held a light for him, and every now and then spoke out some fragment of her father's past evils, an anti-eulogy to keep them at their task, perhaps. She said she guessed the only thing they had ever done together that approached being fun was going to the pistol range, of all places, where he had taught her to fire the automatic. Jack did not need the reinforcement. He wanted to get the grisly container out of sight forever. He wished for the burial, the undeniable death, to close off the gruesomeness that fueled Marley's peculiarity. It was with timid hope that he dumped in the last shovelful and patted down the mound as best he could. "I don't think that will take long to settle," he said. A thought came that changed the quality of his sweat. "Do the neighborhood kids ever come through here?" She swept light across the thick curtain of life around them. "They're afraid to, I think. I've never found any trash or traces of anyone having been. Their parents have made them paranoid." "Assured," he said. "Reminds me of the wood that grew up around Sleeping Beauty." It was an incongruous epitaph, perhaps, but she reached out from the dark and took his blistered hand. The path back to the porch was almost as squeezed as the narrow lanes inside the house. He had the sensation of bushes and branches closing ranks behind them to help hide their deed. They broke free, but she continued pulling him along. He leaned the shovel against the porch jamb in passing as he was drawn inside toward the interior stairs. "Come up," she whispered. This time, despite himself, he shared some sense of the sheltering surround as it stooped over their narrow bedding place. Sunday morning, he drove her to his apartment so that it could both shower. "Mr. Neat," she said, looking around at the studio, which he considered far from orderly. Everything's relative. There was something very encouraging about her ability to deal with his open living space and her obvious savoring of the hot water in the shower. She let him massage the shampoo into her hair, turning round and round with the shut-eyed half-smile of someone being pampered at a spa. He suspected that he might have brought her more pleasure in the past 24 hours than she had experienced in all her previous life. The thought of that gave him a feeling of power as strong as a drug. They bought bagels and coffee on the way back. As he steered around the bend approaching her house, he saw a beat-up bronze pickup in the driveway behind her station wagon. "Whose truck is that?" She just shook her head and pulled the neck of her sweatshirt up over her mouth. Tall, stooped man in the beige work clothes was examining the rank of items they dragged out to the curb. The morning sun glistened on dark, slick-back hair from another day and age. "Must be someone interested in the trash pile," he said. "No, I know him." Her voice held the same tone she'd used while resurrecting her old man's sins the night before. "Who is he?" Jack said, pulling into the curb. The man looked up and flashed a yellowish, toothy grin in their direction. "That's the man my mother bought a lot of her heavy stuff from. He helped her move it in, too. Even the things that were covering my father. She called him Gerard. I don't know his last name." The man stayed put, his hand patting the top of an old pool filter. "Hiya, Marley girl. Long time no see." She wouldn't get out. "Tell him to go away, Jack." Jack emerged and looked over the top of the car. "Your truck is blocking me out of the driveway," he said, keeping it neutral. "Oh, sorry about that. Ain't been another car here since Marley's pop lived with them. You heard from your old pop, kiddo?" Marley said nothing. The man persisted. "I haven't heard from your mom in a while either. How's she doing? How come she's just dumping this stuff on the lawn? She told me she had a master plan to resell everything at a profit." "Marley's mom doesn't live here anymore." "Is that so? Where'd she go to?" The unsavory smile had grown quizzical, but Marley stared straight ahead through the windshield. "I'd like to get into the driveway," Jack said. "Sure. Wally, I don't suppose you mind if I haul some of this stuff away, do you? I mean, it's just garbage now, right? Knock yourself out, Jack said for her. Think you could give me a hand with a couple of the heavier things?
Don't help him, Wally said through her teeth.
Sorry, Gerard, but my back's out of whack.
Gerard stooped to see Marley a little better.
You remembered my name, sweetheart.
He straightened and went to his truck. Once inside, Jack stood on a plastic milk basket, watching through the front door window as the man went through some sort of weird selection process and eventually disappeared with a flatbed full of metal.
Good riddance, he called out, stepped down. Marley, who had been crouched in the walkway, stood up.
I forgot how much I hated him, she said.
He had a bad influence on my mother.
You mean like coercing her into buying all that crap from him?
Worse than that, I think. He might have talked her into killing my father. I just can't remember it all. They were talking in riddles, and I was so young.
That's not good. If he knows what happened back then, if he had a hand in it, he knows we might have uncovered something.
He was trying to figure that out from the way we behaved toward him. That's why I didn't want to get close or talk to him. But I don't think it worked.
All the morning's pleasure had left her face.
Well, how is he going to make trouble for us if he's in so deep himself?
He'll find a way, she said. We should never have moved the things out.
Jack's power had been illusion. Suddenly, Gerard was the one who controlled her fate. Molly lost all interest in the reclamation project. She went out to the porch and huddled in her chair, watching the bushes and trees lean and sway. Jack stood by, racking his brain for a course of action.
Can't you remember more details about him? Do you really think he could have been an accomplice?
Buried, she said. I buried those days. Buried, like my father.
When's the last time you might have talked to your mother?
I don't know. She's been gone for a year, but it's much, much longer than that since I've seen him.
Maybe he was in jail. We should try to talk to your mother.
The green eyes were set like fractured glass in the wan face that turned to him.
My mother is in a place where nothing can break through to her.
Jack thought he detected envy in those words.
Do you think he knows about the money? He must have wondered where she got the cash to pay for the things he brought her. He might think there's a lot more left.
I believe he mainly enjoyed coming in and out of our lives, like a snake tasting us with his tongue.
Words were starting to sound crazy.
You think he'll be back?
He's not finished.
He did seem kind of manipulative, but would he risk a murder charge just to make you suffer?
We shouldn't have moved anything, she said.
Jack's plan was crude, but at least it involved action of sorts. He drove his car a few blocks to a mini mall lot, bought some more food, and carried the sack back to her place on foot, keeping a careful eye out for the dingy pickup.
We'll see how interested he really is, he said, pouring energy drink for them both.
He might wait a week before coming back. Are you going to stay with me the whole time? What about your job?
Let's play it by ear, kiddo. But I'm not leaving you here alone, and we can't leave the house untended until we get an idea of what he's up to.
They spent the rest of the daylight hours indoors with the decaying odors. He held her close, but they did not converse much. The long silences allowed sounds of furtive life to reach his ears. Sometimes he went to investigate, though she would listlessly shake her head at his concern. When it grew dark, they left the lights off. Keeping a flashlight handy, they posted themselves in the room where they'd found the body bag. It was largely cleared, but still offered some hiding spots. Jack figured Gerard would check that room out first if he was as knowledgeable about family affairs as Marley thought. There were two windows in the room. The only one had been cleared enough to allow entry. Jack cracked it for air and to better hear outside sounds. They settled behind a portable patio grill and a big wine chiller, both covered by the same drop cloth. It reminded him of the sheet and furniture forts he and his siblings had built as kids, though it did not offer the same feeling of safety that had crowded in so snugly back then.
He put his arm around Marley as they leaned back against the wall, but she couldn't seem to rest easy. An intermittent breeze stirred up in the late evening, fooling him again with the movement it engendered. Eventually, he was so positive someone was testing the window screen that he shushed into Marley's ear and crawled away from her toward the open window. He stood up beside it and listened. Something brushed against the mesh. Insect? He heard shallow breaths drawn in through a clogged nostril. Silence. And then from a few steps away, a tiny metallic sound. He crawled back to her. "I think he's headed to the back of the house," he whispered. "Can he get the gate open from this side? Is it clear?" Clear enough. Her whisper was a faint exhalation, ghostly. "Wait here." He continued crawling, which made it a little easier to follow the path in the dark. Still, he mainly blundered along, trying not to imagine what might fall under his groping hand. He kept the light off, holding it like a club. It took him a few minutes to feel his way to the kitchen. Luckily, he had not dislodged anything that might have given him away. Reaching the door to the outer porch, he stood up slowly and listened. The breeze stirred in the jungle and then stopped abruptly. It came and went for another few minutes, but he could not detect a presence for sure. A quick splash of indirect light ignited inside the foliage, crowding the tight path that led from the clearing. It went out immediately, but soon a body was pushing through. Jack's eyes were still adjusted enough to see a blot emerge from the deeper shadows and come forward to press itself against the screen door. He flicked on the flashlight, and Gerard quickly backed away from the screen, putting up the shovel he'd found as if he intended using the blade to block off the blinding glare. Jack's ear popped. Gerard chunked himself in the face with the shovel blade like one of the Stooges. He staggered back toward the trail, started to turn clumsily as Marley came out of the kitchen doorway and glided past Jack like she was on wheels. "Keep the light on him," she hissed, and fired twice more through the screen before the suppressed automatic jammed. He heard the jingle of the third shell on the patio floor. She pushed open the screen door, but stopped because Jack had diverted the light to her. She turned, squinting, and took the flash away from him. The door banged shut, much louder than any of the three shots she had fired. He followed her into the trail. Gerard had only taken a couple steps before another round had caught him high up between the shoulder blades. Marley squatted over the tangled work boots and played the light along the length of his body. Jack squeezed past her, feeling like he just survived an explosion. He could find no pulse. "I hit the shovel on the first one," she said. "I think one of the other rounds missed, though." She shone the light ahead. Jack tried to remember if there was a house immediately behind Marley's yard that would be in line with the errant shot. There were intervening tree trunks and a wooden fence along the back, but also plenty of space between. He listened for the sounds of aroused neighbors, a siren. They both waited a long while for a reaction from the outside world or a stir of life from the man on the ground. Nothing. At last, Marley bent down and pulled the shovel free of the undergrowth. "Here, Jack. No one's coming. Let's bury him." "Get his keys," Jack heard himself say. "We'll see if we can't find his truck and get it out of the area. Someone who saw him here earlier might put two and two together." "Right. But let's get him in the ground first. There's plenty of room for everyone." "Everyone? My father? Gerard? And my mother? It's time to bring Mommy out, too. I just couldn't let her go, Jack. I couldn't let her go, but now I have you to help me. And after that, we'll go treasure hunting."
That was Chris Music reading The Horde. The story was published in the July-August 2014 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, visit our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand, electronic issues and subscriptions are also available for e-readers, iPads, and Androids. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Schribo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.